From the Sky News Centre at 5, the Defence Secretary Liam Fox has resigned. He's faced several allegations about his links to his best friend Adam Werety, who accompanied the minister on 18 foreign trips. That's despite Mr. Werety having no official role. Dr. Fox says he mistakenly allowed the distinction between personal and government activities to become blurred. Shadow Defence Minister Kevin Jones says he had to go.
Governments have got to have rules and ministers have got to have standards, and it was clear from the beginning of this that Liam Fox had fell foul of the standards we expect and had broken the rules.
Energy firms are being accused of profiteering after a report revealed they're making £125 a year per customer. Ofgem's examined average dual fuel bills. Vincent Tabak wept in the dock today as a jury was shown pictures of Joanna Yates' strangled body. Tabak denies murdering the landscape architect in Bristol last December, but admits manslaughter. A Conservative MP has apologised for throwing confidential papers into a public litter bin in London. Oliver Letwin's been quick to tell reporters there were no classified documents in the bundle of 100 he threw away, but they did include letters from his constituents in West Dorset. Mr Letwin's issued an apology and promised not to dispose of official papers in public bins in future.
I do apologise because I do understand that constituents may feel that I shouldn't have allowed their papers to be in that bin. It is, of course, embarrassing.
The Professional Jockeys Association has sent detailed proposals to the British Horse Racing Authority in an attempt to defuse the row over the new whip rules. A number of riders are planning to strike on Monday, while Richard Hughes has quit the sport until the guidelines are re-examined. And an American teenager who faked a pregnancy for a high school project has earned a movie and book deal. Gabby Rodriguez from Washington State was 17 when she told an assembly she'd worn a prosthetic baby bump for 6 months to see how the community would react. That's the latest. I'm Claire Gregory.
Hello, Bristol, and welcome to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. Tony Gosling and helping us to review the news this week, including the announcement today of the resignation of the Defence Secretary and North Somerset MP Liam Fox, is Labour Councillor to St George West Ron Stone. And if you're wondering why we've had so few Conservatives on recently, I can assure you that's not for want of trying, but more of that after 6 o'clock. Also, old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, as the Occupy Wall Street movement spreads across the US and with a call tomorrow to occupy the London's Stock Exchange, are we about to see Britain join in? We look at how it's been the left in Europe that's led the push for deregulation and privatisation of banking. And also, organised crime gangs in government, the City of London and the Metropolitan Police. David Southwell has a special report. The underpants bomber, Alexander Litvinenko's inquest, a new opposition movement in Syria and more bombs in Egypt. Well, maybe that's no revolution back in the spring in Egypt, just a military coup. Anyway, what prospects are there for December's planned Egyptian elections? We discuss a lot of international stories after 6 o'clock. Finally, driving us crazy as our roads fill with potholes, is our driving getting worse? How much is the rise of the HGV and the car to do with this? We now got about 500,000 HGVs and 30 million cars on our roads. Is that the result of market forces, or has our public transport been deliberately nobbled by the oil industry and the roads lobby? That's in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 7 Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs of 16 Celsius, sunny on Saturday, but cloudier on Sunday. Next week, highs of 13 Celsius, wet and windy at the beginning of the week, sunny towards the end of the week next week. And next weekend, that's the 22nd and 23rd of October, highs of 13 Celsius, sunny spells and showers and windy. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, time to introduce this week's guest, and joining us is Labour Councillor for St George West, Ron Stone. Hi, Ron, and welcome to Drive Time.
Good evening, everybody.
Now, first of all, mayors and police commissioners. This is slightly an American, many people say American-style thing. What are your thoughts about the idea of having elected mayors in the city and also an elected police commissioner?
Well, I've got a personal position on it, in as much that I still see the possibility of a single individual having an awful lot of influence and potential in relation to, if you like, corruption and those sort of issues. I'm uncomfortable with it, but the final decision on this will be the residents of the city. And if they go with the idea of an elected mayor, because that's their democratic right, then I prefer it to be a Labour mayor rather than anybody else.
What about on the police side of things? Because the implication in all this, I mean, it has to be said, the Liberal Democrats have been very vocal, saying that they don't like this at all, but it seems it may happen anyway. The police commissioner, one individual person, rather than the police authority actually being responsible for managing
again,
the police.
Again, I think that's a loss of democracy. And in relation to the elected mayors, I mean, you know, I've been a councillor for a long time, and you begin to wonder what your role will be and exactly how effective you will be, and whether you'll be totally sidelined down to doing very menial tasks, and whether it's worth the effort to actually stand.
Okay, you are a councillor in St George West. What are the sorts of issues that have been brought up there at the moment?
Well, locally, well, the Parks and Green Space strategy is and the outcome in relation to some of our public casual open spaces is the biggest single hot issue. The redevelopment of the park, the car park, and the issues around the operation of the lake and the impact between fishing and wildlife, that's the big issues, and that was only being debated last night.
OK, I'm also joined by old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Martin, tax havens, there's been a big report from ActionAid this week about many of our biggest companies, a quarter at least of the biggest on the Financial Times share index, the FTSE index, being actually holding most of their assets abroad and in places like the Channel Islands.
Well, that's right. I mean, that's just a fact, as it has been for many years, although it's a completely unsatisfactory state of affairs. Basically, many of these tax havens are, in fact, British-dependent territories. So if we wanted to clean up our act on this front, the ball's in our court. The Germans are pushing us to do exactly that.
OK, well, the big story, which really just broke about half an hour ago, is the resignation of North Somerset MP Liam Fox. So, Ron, what's your reaction to that, first of all? He's the Defence Secretary, he used to be in opposition, the health spokesman for the Conservatives, and the pressure has been building on him. Many people think it's just been for the last 18 months, but the Chief of the Defence Staff, Sir Jock Stirrup, actually, before he finished his job, he was sort of squeezed out early last autumn. Mention this really rather soon after Liam Fox was actually appointed, just after the elections last year. So why is it that the most senior army, in fact he was from the Air Force, but the most senior forces official can raise this almost straight after the general election, and it takes this amount of time for anything to happen about it? Not only that, Jock Stirrup was forced to resign early.
Yeah, I know. I mean, there's so many strands to this story that are either bizarre or mysterious. I think that the first thing you've got to remember is that Liam Fox and David Cameron are no friends, because they stood against each other for the leadership, Fox lost. Cameron needed Fox in relation to carrying the right wing of the Tory party with a high-level job somewhere, and he's ended up in defence. Then there was the spat between Cameron and Fox in relation to defence cuts, if you remember. Why were we building aircraft carriers and no aircraft to put them in, and the cuts that have gone on in the armed forces over a period of time. And so I don't think there's any real love lost between those two. But I think in relation to the issues that have been in the press and media, I mean, it was obvious from the start that Liam Fox actually lied the first time he was actually asked the question of whether this gentleman was actually accompanying him to trips, and he said no, and there were photographic evidence of him sitting in the back row or right next to his side. I think then there's the issue in relation to the role of Liam Fox, in relation to the fact that as a minister, he's got extra responsibilities for major defence contracts and placements, multi-million pound deals, etc. And also there's the question of where his role meets national security. So to have some friend, best man, hanging on, meeting people at high level I've got no idea, and there are suggestions in relation to what he had in relation to benefits from these trips, etc. Sad thing is probably now that Liam Fox is gone, whether he jumped or he was pushed, we probably won't get a full investigation as to exactly what was going on in the time that he was the minister.
Well, and also, I think it's fair to say, if you have a look at on the internet, as I've just been doing, loads of stuff is coming out right now about some of the people who are funding Adam Werratty. One of them is Michael Hintz, who runs something called CQS, which is a hedge fund with tens of millions of dollars in arms interests. Another one is this corporate intelligence firm, G3, was also funding him. Lobbyists and foreign powers funding someone who was working very closely with the Defence Secretary and saying that he was his advisor, basically a kind of shadow foreign policy. Another person who was funding him was Podu Zabludowicz, who is an Israeli arms tycoon. Martin, do you think it was inevitable, given the fuss over Liam Fox earlier this week, that he was going to go?
Well, I think he's just been caught out. If he hadn't, I think civil service are obviously the people who've grasped this up. And I think what people need to focus on here is not the personal relationship between Werratty and Fox so much as who's paying for these people. As you've just given us a very suggestive list of who the paymasters are, including, it looks like, the Israeli government. So we've got an Israeli government agent sitting in on high-level secret talks about arms deals that Britain is doing. Now, that is just out of order, frankly. I mean, it goes on all the time, but this is just blatant. And I'd just like to agree with what Ron said. The real pity of Fox's resignation is that now this will all be kicked into touch and everybody will forget all about it. But they shouldn't forget about it, because this is the way sausages are made. There's all sorts of skullduggery going on at the edges of the Conservative Party's fundraising exercises. And this is what people need to focus on.
Well, in the Evening Post only yesterday, David Paul Pasley, a leading Conservative councillor in Portishead, said that he'd written to the 50-year-old MP Liam Fox to give his full support. Mr. Pasley said, "There's no doubt that there are questions which need to be answered, but in this country, a person is innocent until proven guilty. The moment this whole unpleasant situation is at risk of becoming a witch hunt, and there's a real risk of there being a trial by media before the full facts are known. It's unfair to accuse people of wrongdoing before the facts and result of the investigation are fully revealed." He said that Dr. Fox is a good MP who's worked hard for his local community, and I have written to him to give him my full support. Councillor Arthur Terry, who's a trustee of North Somerset Conservative Association and also chair of Portishead Town Council, said, "I think this is a very unfortunate matter. Liam has served his constituency well. I'm sad that this matter has come about. Tory supporters from across the constituency continue to support Mr. Fox, sending him messages of support at the association offices in Nailsea High Street." So this has been this is actually yesterday's Bristol Evening Post. Things have changed a lot, Ron, haven't they, since yesterday?
Well, absolutely, yes. And I don't think you knew, but I stood against Liam Fox in 1992 when he came as a GP. And stood and won the constituency for the first time.
Which constituency was that then?
That was Woodspring, as it was then. It's now North Somerset.
They keep changing them. It seems every general election, they keep changing them around.
I mean, in all honesty, I met the guy, and at that time he seemed a reasonable guy. He didn't believe and support his politics, and I think there have been cases that he's done work in the constituency. But in the course of that particular election, there was a number of issues of casework that he point-blank refused to take up. One was, I got a guy out of Madrid jail that was wrongly accused of murder. I got him home on Christmas Day. And there was the reopening of a quarry next to Clevedon, and he refused to fight that. And I, with the residents, managed to find a way in which, although we couldn't stop them getting the legal ability to open it, you ended up with restricting the number of lorry movements, and therefore it was non-viable and never happened.
Martin, one of the other sides to this, of course, and it was in The Guardian a couple of days ago, is Liam Fox revelations sap Ministry of Defence morale. What do you think about this? And I mentioned before this whole business of Jock Stirrup actually bringing this up just after the general election.
Well, I think he hasn't got the confidence of the Ministry of Defence, that's quite clear, and that's probably what's been decisive in getting him removed. But I think, let's think about the politics of this now. Cameron removing Fox. Fox was the standard bearer for the right wing of the party. They're going to take this as a slap in the face. It's going to make David Cameron's job of party management that much more difficult. And of course, as we go forward and the economic policy of the coalition collapses, which I think is probably going to happen before Christmas as the deficit increases, there's the possibility of a civil war inside the Tory party, because they're not in fact united about most things. Some of them are actually quite sensible and some of them are bonkers.
Okay, on to our next story. And yesterday in Parliament, we're going to have a little listen to that now from Tuesday. In fact, I've got a couple of clips from that. It was a very busy day. I guess that's it must have been on Monday, mustn't it, in the Houses of Parliament. And this first one is from Susan Hume, and it's a report on the passage of the Health and Social Care Bill, that is to say reforms to the National Health Service, in the House of Lords as it passed through there.
The Shadow Health Minister, Lady Thornton, claimed the bill would fundamentally change the nature of the NHS.
It will change the NHS from a health system into a competitive market. It will turn patients into consumers. It will turn patients' choice into shopping. And most crucially of it all, it will turn our healthcare into a traded commodity. So, my lords, I start with a fundamental and very simple point. People did not expect, did not vote for, and do not want these changes.
Yeah. Lady Jolly is co-chair of the Liberal Democrats Committee at Westminster on Health, and she was not an enthusiast for the bill.
As a Liberal Democrat, I know only too well that many areas of this bill, for the most part, fall outside the coalition agreement, which, by the way, I voted to support in May 2010. In fact, it drives a coach and horses through the agreement.
A senior Liberal Democrat who has criticised the reforms, Lady Williams, was, like Lord Owen, worried about the hands-off role of the Secretary of State. There was, after all, a lot of money at stake.
To put it very simply, my lords, the spending of £128 billion of taxpayers' money requires the presence of a minister who is responsible and accountable for those huge sums of money. It is an essential part of parliamentary responsibility and of a democratic system. My lords, I fear the consequences if we fail to address this issue.
No such qualms for a former Conservative Health Secretary, Lady Bottomley. She said she, like most peers, had received a letter before the debate begging peers to make sure their grandchildren got the same benefit from the NHS she had enjoyed.
I don't want my grandchildren to have the same benefits. My grandchildren have high standards, and I want, as do everybody else's in this house, I want our grandchildren to have a better, more responsive, more effective, cost-effective NHS, and only through this bill will they achieve that.
That was the former Health Secretary, Virginia Bottomley, there, finishing that report from yesterday in Parliament by Susan Hume. Now, what she's saying essentially there, Virginia Bottomley, Ron, is that actually this is going to be a much more cost-effective health service once these changes are through.
Who for? Because I think it's a totally retrograde step and moves away from healthcare being free and available on demand when you need it. The idea that you've got, even at local level, your GPs being able to outsource or manage services when basically they've been trained to help people to get well. I don't think they train to be accountants and financial managers. That's the first thing, and I think that's a retrograde step. And secondly, in relation to issues, if you look in my own family, for example, the impact of what's going on, my wife needs a hip replacement. We were due to have consultation a month ago. It's been cancelled, along with many of the other non-life-threatening, as they say, operations, and people are having to put up with pain and discomfort for a lot longer. While these people, if you like, look to make a profit or in relation to being able to fund this to their own benefit.
But no, Ron, actually what's happening here, at least according to people like Virginia Bottomley, is that as we go out to the market, these health various changes and various health operations, all sorts of areas of healthcare will be there ready for the highest or should we say the lowest bidder. So we're going to be getting better value for money as we all pay our taxes to the health service. This is a way of making sure that that service is provided as cheaply as possible.
Yeah, but if you look at the way in which some of the GPs, consultancies and surgeries were set up in relation to where they put services and what inducements have been put in the way, I'm still not convinced of that argument, I'm sorry.
Well, that's right. I mean, politically, there's no leg to stand on here. It's gone to the Lords, and the Lords should chuck it out because it's not in the Conservative Party manifesto. None of this was in the Conservative Party manifesto. They haven't got a mandate for it. And, of course, this idea that somehow bringing in the private sector will reduce costs is laughable.
They're pointing out there that it's also not in the coalition agreement.
Well, of course, it isn't in the coalition agreement. It's not even the Tory Party manifesto. I mean, the Liberals could say, we don't want to do this, but the Tories, at least we've got a mandate to do it, but they haven't got that. And this was all sprung on the electorate after the polls closed. So that's the first point. So I think the House of Lords are absolutely right to chuck it out and say, go away and have another think about it. The other point I would make is it's not cheaper to have the private sector. All the evidence shows, look at the United States of America, they've got massive private involvement. Any willing provider is definitely part of their setup, and they spend a fortune on transactions costs. The beauty of the NHS, in fact, it's not the best in the world, but by God, it's the cheapest because it buys in bulk, it's got a plan, it's got a monopsony buyer position in relation to all the suppliers. That's the way you do it. The reason for the NHS to be the structure it is because it's the cheapest and most efficient method to provide universal healthcare. And the private sector will not make things cheaper, it will make things more expensive, just as cutting public expenditure will not reduce the deficit either. And that will become increasingly clear.
Now, as they were pointing out in Parliament on Monday, marketising the health service has one big problem. So let's go back to 2 weeks ago to hear what one independent trader says about the market.
I'm fairly confident the euro is going to crash and it's going to fall pretty hard because markets are ruled right now by fear. Investors and the big money, the smart money, I'm talking about the big funds, the hedge funds, the institutions, they don't buy this rescue plan. They know the market is toast. They know the stock market is finished. The euro, as far as they're concerned, they don't really care. They're moving their money away to safer assets, like treasury bonds, 30-year bonds, and the US dollar. So it's not going to work.
Alessio Rastani there speaking on the BBC saying the market is toast, and that's a bit worrying if they're considering marketising the health service, Ron.
Well, absolutely, and I think if it's another element or part of international capitalism in what it does with monies and how it tries to either invest or avoid.
Well, I mean, that's very revealing from that guy. I mean, all the insiders know the market is toast. There was an IMF guy on the Newsnight saying they've got 3 weeks to come up with a deal to save the euro, otherwise there's going to be a banking meltdown. And, of course, the real problem with the collapse of Dexia Bank in Belgium the other day, which was bought out 100% by the French and Belgian governments, is that a collapse of the European banking system, because of basically Greece will be the first domino. Their budget deficit has increased as a result of the austerity policies that have been forced on them. The market can see the writing on the wall. Greece isn't going to pay. The European banks are going to collapse. But all the British and American banks are holding credit default swaps on the European banks. And in the modern world, the collapse of the banking system will happen in an afternoon. One crucial keystroke will be put in by one person, and just like the start of an earthquake or a tsunami, the whole thing will go down. And I don't think even Ed Balls has got his head around this. At the Labour Party conference, he was talking about what we would do with the windfall profits from selling the nationalised banks, RBS and Lloyds. Now, RBS and Lloyds have been losing money for all the time they've been in the taxpayers' hands. The taxpayer at the moment has lost something like $30 billion on holding those assets. So the idea that they're going to make any money on this, especially if there's a banking crash, is basically fantasy. And I think once we've had the crash, we'll have a serious discussion about the kind of socialist policies that we need to put this country back together. But I'm afraid we're not going to do that until we've had the crash. We're on the road now to the crash, and the crash will happen.
But they're not necessarily socialist policies, are they? I mean, Keynes was a liberal. He was talking about this kind of using the government actually actively spending into the economy and getting consumer spending going by building things, basically.
Yes, well, I mean, but that could work into a socialist policy. It's the kind of policy that was pursued by the Labour government in 1945 and by Democrat governments in the US. I mean, at the end of the day, if the banking system collapses, you're not talking... I mean, in Keynes's day, the banks were insolvent, but not but were illiquid. That means they didn't have enough cash, but they were basically solvent. So if the government spent money, and of course the government was balancing its budget into the crash, they were able to then spend money and restart the thing. But what's happened in the last 4 years is all the resources that the government might have used for a Keynesian policy has been given to the banks. Look at the QE that came out the other week. Was it 75 billion? They've given it to the banks. Now the banks are just going to hoard it or take it to the casino. They're never going to spend it into the economy. That was stupid. And of course what will happen when the banks have collapsed is that the state will be bankrupt, the banks will be bankrupt, society will be bankrupt, but a tiny minority of the population will hold all the wealth. Now that is what Marx called the revolutionary situation, and I'm afraid it's not a question of liking it or not liking it. That is where we're going.
Well, the quantitative easing you're talking about, we sat down and worked out that every man, woman and child in Britain, if it was to be given to them instead, would get £1,250.
And that would have been a much more sensible use of it.
Going to the banks. Anyhow, from finance to nuclear power, and also back to the House of Commons on Monday, where the future of our two nuclear power stations which are being planned for Oldbury and Hinkley was up for discussion. And here again is the BBC's Susan Hume.
The Energy Secretary Chris Huhne has told MPs that the nuclear industry in the UK can carry on after a review into safety following the Fukushima disaster in Japan. The nuclear plant there was severely damaged by the underwater earthquake and tsunami in March. The review was to look at whether British plants were sufficiently resilient, and Mr Huhne said the Chief Nuclear Inspector, Dr Mike Waitman, found no fundamental weaknesses in the current licensing regime or safety principles.
Dr. Waitman continues to see no reason to curtail the operation of nuclear power plants or other nuclear facilities. Here in the UK, he believes the industry has reacted responsibly and appropriately, displaying strong leadership for safety and safety culture.
Mr. Huhne was answering a demand for an urgent statement from the Labour MP and opponent of nuclear power, Paul Flynn, who cited internal government emails reported in the Guardian newspaper. These, he said, showed that officials were keen not to derail plans for new nuclear plants.
They were internal emails which showed that the business and energy departments worked closely behind the scenes with the multinational corporations, EDF, Areva and Westinghouse, to try to ensure that the accident did not derail their plans for a new generation of nuclear stations in Britain. This is quite a disgraceful, scandalous collusion between the government and those companies who have a commercial interest in making large sums of money out of nuclear power.
Mr. Huhne said the emails were not from his department.
The particular email he quotes, I believe, actually came from an official in the business department rather than Department of Energy and Climate Change. And no, I don't approve at all of the tenor of those remarks, nor are they the tenor of the policy making that we conduct in the Department of Energy and Climate Change.
Mr. Flynn said the review should have considered the costs of nuclear power as well as safety. But Mr. Huhne said Dr. Waitman had rightly thought safety was more important. Costs, he said, were for the operators.
Now, Martin, that report from Monday in the Houses of Parliament, what are your thoughts there? Because it looks as if from these leaked emails to The Guardian that what's been going on behind the scenes is that all the companies that want these nuclear power stations have had special access when it's regarding this report into safety and the whole idea of whether these plants are actually going to be economically viable or not. The government are taking no responsibility for that. They're saying, well, this is just up to the energy companies.
Well, this is just silly, isn't it? I mean, they're only viable as long as there's a cap on the payouts that you have to make in terms of accidents and wastes. If these companies were actually having to take out private insurance against accidents, the private insurance industry would just go, no. And that's why the government has to be involved to underwrite the whole shebang.
But at the end of the day, it's these energy companies like EDF that want to build Hinkley Power Station number 3. It's their responsibility, surely, to say, actually, we can afford to do this.
Yeah, but only if they're prepared to take on all the costs, including the potential costs of an accident. Now, the private sector will price up the potential costs of an accident, and the cost to them of the insurance of doing that is prohibitive, and you wouldn't build a nuclear power station. When they tried to privatise nuclear power in the 1980s, I wrote a paper about this for the New Economics Foundation. They tried to privatise it. They took it to the City of London. And when it was made clear to them that they would have to be responsible for the waste and for accidents, they just said, no, it's a dog poo, we don't want it. And the only places where nuclear power has actually ever gone ahead is with government support and saying, we will pick up the tab if anything goes wrong. Unless the government does that, It's just not viable.
Ron, what's your thoughts about the prospects for nuclear power stations, new nuclear power stations at Oldbury and Hinkley? Is it something that you think would be a good idea? Because one of the things which is always cited, is always cited that this is actually really good for climate change purposes, and also that they don't actually chuck out carbon like almost every other form of
energy.
Near
the wind farms. Sorry, but personal experience at a nuclear industry as an Avon councillor. I was on Barclay and Oldbury liaison committee, and I stood in for a colleague at Hinkley at one of the liaison meetings. This is where residents and local communities meet with the management about on a three-month basis. The report that we had given to us actually had a very interesting phrase in it. It said, a known unusual release of activation product. It's been written on my brain ever since. That's a leak. And it took me 9 months of trying to find out what happened. This is at a time when the nuclear industry was saying, we're cuddly friendly, come and eat your sandwiches on top of our reactor, we're safe. In doing that in the meeting, I was escorted in around the site, even into the gents, by five members of the security team. I was followed home. My phone was tapped, etc.
So how do you actually know that your phone was tapped?
Because it's tapped so badly, I could hear them on the other end. So what I used to do was to read my shopping list to them and tell them where I was going and tell them to save fuel and petrol and save the planet. I set up a meeting we had in the October with John Prescott and Roger Berry and Dawn Primrolo, and made these accusations in the earshot of the press media. And at 10:15 at night, I got a phone call. Guess who from? The manager of Hinkley Power Station with the answer. And this is, I've gone to the Hinkley Inquiry and made all these accusations in public, trying to promote a debate, just like we're having now. And do you know what happened? When you get the nuclear rods out and they're put to cool.
The fuel rods, yeah.
Yeah. What they did, instead of storing the water correctly and opening the right valve and putting it into a container to go to Sellafield and be decontaminated, they opened the wrong one and irradiated Kilve Beach.
What you're saying ultimately is your experience from the nuclear power industry.
Don't
is...
trust them.
Okay. Martin, final word on the economics of all this.
Well, as I say, whenever they've tried to run this out as a proper private sector exercise where you must take responsibility for the costs of accidents and waste, the private sector throws up its arms and walks away. So the government has to subsidise, or at least implicitly subsidise, what's going on by saying, we will pick up the problem if there is a problem. Look at they're all privately owned nuclear power plants in Japan, but it's not the private owners that are paying the money to try and close down. I mean, they're still melting down. They've got three meltdowns simultaneously going on in Japan and have been going on for months now, which are actually irradiating virtually the whole Pacific. And of course, it isn't the private companies that are attempting to control the situation, it's the government of Japan, because the private companies have long ago run out of assets and capability. And that's if that's factored in, and it has to be factored in, then the private sector doesn't want to know. So they're not viable under free market conditions.
Now, quite a lot has come out about the whole nuclear power industry because of the Fukushima business. There are all sorts of allegations about radiation levels in the surrounding area being much higher than they should be, and also about nuclear materials being illegally stored by the private TEPCO power station. So is that true? Or are those true?
Well, I mean, obviously, this is what you have investigations for. I can't sit here in a radio studio in Bristol and say what's going on inside the Fukushima plant. That's absurd. Somebody else should be responsible for that, and they should get to the bottom of it. But it looks like they've got basically weapons-grade material in there that was being stored, part of some secret nuclear Japanese nuclear program. And the other thing, of course, is the Stuxnet worm, which we're probably going to discuss later, which was released into the Iranian nuclear
industry. This is a computer virus.
It's a computer virus, very, very sophisticated computer virus. And we've got information coming out now that was developed at Dimona, which is the Israeli nuclear complex with the US and the Israelis developing this virus and then introducing it into the Iranian nuclear industry, closing down, you know, it's specifically designed to hit nuclear.
Yeah, how does this virus work then? I'm not sure. It's on a USB stick, I believe. This is what I remember reading. But what it does, I mean, I don't know how it works. Maybe you know. This is all a bit above us.
I don't know. I mean, I'm just reading.
One of the things that it does, well, I had a look at this a few months ago when it hit the news, was that the reactor starts doing all sorts of weird things, because the whole thing is controlled by a computer, and yet the screens in the control room, the reactor room, looks like everything's normal, while all sorts of crazy stuff is going on in the reactor.
It's a very, very sophisticated computer virus, so sophisticated that those who've looked at it said it must have been developed by a state. And we've got here, we've got this coming up later, or perhaps we can just discuss it now, Tom Pavlenty, who is an ex-Republican, ex-governor in the US, blatantly says we developed that virus and it was a good thing. So it's out of the bag that the US and the Israelis developed this virus. Now there is a suspicion, because it's not actually as targeted as they would like, that it leaked into the Japanese nuclear industry and played a part in
This is the trouble with these viruses. You're never quite sure where they're going to spread to.
Indeed. So
they
what
may
we,
even contaminate your own nuclear
indeed,
power station.
Indeed. So what we've got here is a rogue virus roaming around the world, which is designed to trash nuclear power stations. Fantastic.
Okay, on to a bit of a more down-to-earth local story. Private rents, actually this is a national one, private rents are unaffordable for families in most English boroughs. Shelter has revealed that families are being priced out of the out-of-control rental market in 55% of English local authorities. This is in Thursday's Guardian. The Shelter Rent Watch found that average private rents were unaffordable for ordinary working families in 55% of local authorities in England. Typical rents charged by private landlords were more than a third of median take-home pay, the widely accepted measure of affordability. Now, this is a bit worrying, isn't it, Ron? Because not only can we not, as everyone's get, it's very difficult to get mortgages, especially for first-time buyers, to actually buy a house. If you find yourself in the private rented sector, we're now told that 55% of people are finding it unaffordable to actually privately rent houses.
Well, one of my responsibilities, apart from neighbourhoods, is housing. And last year, I was trying to find out what was the coalition's policy on housing, because it's the one issue that they hadn't uttered a single word on since they formed their self. And what I did, I did a comparison across Bristol of council rents and against the average in the private sector. And if you took St George, for example, the average 2-3 bedroom council house, the rental for a private dwelling of that was more than double, and that was last year. Now Bristol's got a relatively buoyant housing market, particularly in the rental side, because yesterday I was looking at some of the estate agents' offers, if you like, that were opposite the council house, and there's rents of over £2,000 a month for flats around the harbour side. I mean, it's absolutely atrocious. Now, I'm not suggesting that the good residents of Speedwell can afford to go to harbour side, because clearly they can't. And the other issue is that the bulk of people that try to get a mortgage have got to save 10% now. That's a huge amount without going into debt of some description, probably with the family. And so I think the whole of the housing market is rapidly getting out of reach of people. And until we get back to building social and council housing on a proper basis, and not just the 12 miserable ones that the government gave us last year, then I think this is going to be a real issue for people in this area.
Well, it's all very well for you to say that as a Labour councillor, Ron, but, you know, we've had however many, ten years or more of a Labour government with hardly any council houses being built at all up until last year.
Yeah, I accept that, but within the last 2 years of the Labour administration, they've changed the process of what we call the housing revenue account and the ability for reinvestment by local authorities. We were banned by law up to then by Margaret Thatcher government, but that was changed. And as we came up to the election, there was large amounts of money ring-fenced to be put out to local councils to do two things: not only to build houses, but to create jobs and keep people in work. And as soon as the administration came in and the coalition came in, all they did was to sweep all that money into a pot to save the bankers. And so we ended up with 12 council houses instead of 76.
Now, Martin, Shelter's analysis showed in England 8% of local authorities were extremely unaffordable to rent in, with an average of 50% or more of full-time take-home pay. 21% were very unaffordable, because you thought maybe if you thought that only 8% were extremely unaffordable. So we got extremely unaffordable at 8%, very unaffordable at 21%, and 29% were fairly unaffordable with these what the average median incomes. It does seem that people that want to find somewhere to live are in a bit of a bind.
They are, but also this has got macroeconomic implications. It's been the albatross round the neck of the British economy for decades, that whenever the economy starts to pick up, house prices pick up, which means those who are on the housing ladder benefit. The people at the bottom benefit less, the people at the top benefit more. But it's it really makes me laugh when people go on about welfare scroungers. And all these people who are on the housing ladder, basically, if they bought at the beginning of the boom like people I know, they've made a fortune. Basically, for many years, it was quite possible to earn more from your house rising in value than you would get for going out to work at a very highly paid middle-class job. Now, that is irrational. In other parts of Europe, housing costs are about 20%, I believe, of a German worker's average salary, and it's deliberately geared to keep, you know, they subsidise reasonable housing for people to make sure that costs are kept down.
So what, are you saying that the number of houses is kept artificially low
to actually
create an increase in value?
It increases value for those who are in the game, which is housing, estate agents and those who benefit from the housing bubble.
But
housing bubbles mean that whenever the economy gets going, you have to raise interest rates to keep the bubble under control, which actually smashes your manufacturing industry, which is why we've got loads of conservatories in this country and not many widget makers.
But the trouble is, of course, that nobody wants a new great big housing estate in their backyard, do they?
No, but you don't need a new big house. There's plenty of empty houses already. Why can't they just be, especially as the housing market is crashing, why couldn't they be bought up at the bottom of the market by local authorities or the government and turned over into social housing?
One thing there's certainly plenty of are empty offices and derelict looking, overgrown with sort of buddleia growing out through
them.
Well,
that's a classic example of investing in the wrong things, isn't it?
Factories and things like that. So, Ron, is there any prospect, do you think, of building new homes on these old industrial, these brownfield sites?
Yeah, well, we've done it already in this area, because Bristol Carpets was an industrial site in Crews Hole. And that's now got something like about, I think it's about 70 or 80 flats on the industrial site. I've got no problem with that. I think that is a way forward. And I think because we've lost so much industry of any sort, it's going to have to be those brownfield sites that councils look to in the first instance, because clearly the coalition and their mates are going to protect the green belt, or the green belt squeeze, if you like, on the fringes in wards like Stockwood, for example.
Okay, now let's go on to have a look again at what was going on in the Houses of Parliament on Monday. This time it's Keith MacDonald on the BBC's Yesterday in Parliament with a fascinating report about, what I think anyway, it's slightly biased, but on investigative journalism and the demise of investigative journalism in Britain, and partly the reason for that being the internet. Here's the report from Keith MacDonald, where we're here also, The Guardian's Nick Davis.
The Lords Communication Committee is inquiring into the state of investigative journalism. Among today's witnesses was Nick Davis, one of The Guardian's top investigative reporters, whose book 3 years ago, Flat Earth News, painted a stark picture of the tendency of news organisations simply to recycle information and not provide original journalism. He said journalists had less time to work on their stories.
We have only a third of the time to spend on each story because of this new corporate world, commercialised world. And if you take time away from reporters, you're taking away our most important working asset. It's like taking steel away from manufacturing cars. We can't do our job properly. So what that means is, on the whole, reporters don't go out and find stories. They don't go out and make contacts. They don't check facts. They sit and passively recycle press releases and what's coming over the wire from Reuters or the Press Association. And both of these sources are inherently unreliable. And that's why we tell you that there are weapons of mass destruction all over Iraq. All the computers in the world are going to blow up on Millennium Eve. You're all about to die from SARS, swine flu, bird flu, all that stuff, day after day, unchecked garbage that isn't true.
So, Piers asked, why was it important to protect investigative journalism?
Well, the reason it's important to protect it is because the world is full of people who would like to control the flow of information. And if you don't challenge them, if you particularly don't stand up to them when they're actively obstructing your access to the important information, then the liars win. And that's not just the world of politics, that's the world of, you know, celebrity and entertainment and sport and corporation. They're all out there manipulating the flow of information.
Peers were keen to hear his views on new media. This was the Labour peer, Lord MacDonald.
Could you not be characterised really as a rather old-fashioned craftsman, who's also a bit of a gatekeeper as well? And what you've got now is that an industrial revolution that's taking place, a new revolution that's just going to sweep past you.
Nick Davis said the internet did provide some positives, but there were serious negatives.
I think we might be going into an era of information chaos, where the mainstream media starts to decline. What's already been the case for a long time is that people treat news as a commodity and they buy the news they want to hear. So that the Daily Mail reader reinforces his view of the world, the Guardian reader reinforces his. What you're now seeing is the consumers becoming producers. Anybody in the world can set up a website and start putting news or pseudo-news out there. And so what the danger is that as we decline, the news organisations, you get an awful fragmentation. So the racists can go to the racist site and get what they call racist news, and the nationalists can get nationalist news, the communists get communist news, and everybody's getting whatever they want to hear about the world, and nobody is sitting there checking and saying, well, hang on a moment, that isn't true, which is what journalism is supposed to be about. And I would say if you had to bet money, that although there are all sorts of unknowns, that's where we might be heading, into information chaos.
Nick Davis there speaking in the... One of the Commons Select Committees, anyway, I think it's a Culture, Media and Sport one, possibly Communications even, on Monday this week. Now, Ron, what about this whole concept of the third of the time being taken away from journalists? So, actually, they're having to do maybe 10 or 12 articles in one day, and so they don't really have the time to check the facts. The easiest thing to do, of course, is get a press release from, I don't know, whether it be from the National Health Service or a private business, and just cut and paste it into the page.
Well, I think you only got to look at the changes to the local newspaper, the Evening Post, to see that's exactly what's happening. The Evening Post has turned from quite a reasonable local paper when I was very small, with stories and journalism as we all understood it, into what I would call now a parish magazine. The whole process of it and its production is based on internet and modern technology now. If you look at that and compare it to the Western Daily Press, you've got the same stories and issues in it, etc., etc. They've cut staff to absolutely a shred and a bone. The reporters have even got come out and take their own photographs, etc., etc. And I think what the guy's saying there is probably very true, in as much that the ability to be able to really do investigative journalism, to check your facts, to be able to produce a story that's real, one, there's the pressure of time, two, all of them are up against the number of copies and sales in relation to what they pay. Three, they're chasing advertisers, etc. And if you look at the majority of papers now, in particular, there's more adverts in there than there is news.
How much, I wonder, with the Evening Post, Ron, as someone who's obviously seen it from the days it was edited and managed by Walter Hawkins, who was a Bristolian, and it was a locally owned newspaper, he actually had loans which eventually he couldn't pay back, and so allowed Northcliffe, which is part of the Daily Mail empire, in the 70s, to actually retake it over, even though the Evening Post back in the 1930s was actually set up to stop the Evening World, which was a Northcliffe paper in the city.
That's right.
So how much do you think that the change in the flavour of what we get here in Bristol from the Post is due to the change in ownership?
Well, I think that's true of all newspapers. I mean, you only got to look at it now that the Union Post is part of a conglomerate. It's always been difficult to get good news into any of the local newspapers. They would rather have a horror story or something that, you know, the council's done something wrong, or you know, this is bad and that's bad. A good news story appears on just before the births, marriages and deaths normally. And so if you look at the general trend in relation to the editorial of those papers, they follow who's backing them.
Martin, what about this whole idea of information chaos Nick Davis is talking about there? Because he's a traditional newspaper print journalist working for The Guardian. Isn't he being a little bit of a Luddite? Because there's quite a lot of the blogs out there. I mean, Craig Murray's blog, for example, there's quite a lot of others, where people who wouldn't normally have access to get articles in the newspaper are able to do it on the internet.
I think that's right. And I think also, you see, the internet does allow you to give links which give your sources. Yeah, so that gives people, if you're unhappy with the fact, properly done internet journalism has all of the sources linked so that you can check the facts as you go. If somebody makes a statement, they should create a link which validates what they're saying. I think the problem is more of an economic one, which is that new technology allows relatively amateur people, basically not trained journalists, to produce stuff which is actually of a very high quality. And I think that nobody knows really how to make this pay. You've got Russia Today out there and Press TV, who are owned by their respective governments.
These are satellite channels, TV.
But they're owned by their respective governments, and therefore, a bit like the BBC, they're above the commercial fray. But commercial journalism is finding it very difficult to operate because it's very... I mean, nobody knows how to sell newspapers anymore and make a profit out of it, apart from through advertising. And that means, of course, advertisers don't like controversy. I once met a guy who was an investigative journalist for The Guardian, and I said, well, I've never seen your name on anything. And he said, well, no, because I don't actually do that. I just check all the facts behind the scenes. And what he said to me is, we've got out of every 10 investigations we're carrying out, and we have to carry out very thorough investigations of everything, only one of those stories will ever end in The Guardian. We have to put it through the lawyers, this, that, the other, before we can actually use it. And some things are scotched by the police, because they come to us and say, look, we're looking into this, we're about to make some arrests, and therefore we don't want you to use the material that you've gathered. And I think investigative journalism is the most expensive of all, because often you have to do research stories which you don't use. And of course, you're usually looking into people who are extremely powerful, wealthy and well-connected, and they've got their ways of shutting you up, and those ways are used. And I think people... I mean, what the internet does give us is a huge... I mean, for example, I read a lot of the Pakistani and Indian English language press, which is now accessible to me at the click of a button. And you get a very different picture of the world from the one you get from our mainstream press in Britain.
What about what Nick was saying there about the wire services, which all the main newspapers use? The thing about Reuters, the Press Association, Associated Press, and quite often they are simply cutting and pasting these wire articles into their newspaper. Well, he's saying there's a real structural problem. He's talking about the weapons of mass destruction, yeah. SARS, also swine flu, bird flu, all these other stories which are actually put out on these wire services, and he's saying that there are lies involved here. And that comment that he made, I thought, was pretty apposite, which is the liars win. And this is a structural problem.
Yeah, well, you've got to recognise, for example, that the State of Israel has hundreds of people working every day to basically produce stories favourable to Israel, and they go through the
It's not just Israel, is it?
No, it's not just Israel. I'm just using them as a for example. I mean, during the run-up to the rebels coming into Tripoli, Al Jazeera broadcast two sequences of film showing what they claimed were people celebrating in Green Square because Gaddafi had gone. Now, that was news to the Gaddafi forces on the outskirts of Tripoli. And what Al Jazeera had done, it became pretty clear towards the end of the day what they'd done. They'd taken pictures of a demonstration in India, because when you look closely, they were carrying Indian flags. And they'd also, because Al Jazeera is based in Qatar, they'd mocked up a paper and paint version of Green Square, and a load of extras had flooded into it, and it was pointed out, no, this isn't Green Square, because various parts of the architecture were not correct. Now, what we're having here is the creation of news as part of a war plan, yeah, as part of perception management, because of course what they were trying to do was break the morale of the pro-Gaddafi forces by showing that the Green Square had already fallen. Now, when you look at any media, you've got to realise that you're being manipulated by whoever it may be. And I think what we've got to do, I mean, people go on about media studies being a non-subject. People, young people have got to be brought up to realise that people use media to tell their own tale in their own way. So one of the first exercises you do in media studies is, right, where is these people coming from? What is their agenda? And you've got to ask yourself when you're looking at anything, what is their agenda? Yeah, and then you can see whether they're twisting, whether they're lying, whether they're trying to, you know, use facts that aren't true.
Okay, well, just to round this up, I'd just like to say that often the journalists get the blame, but let's remember the journalists don't own the transmitters and the journalists don't own the printing presses.
And they've all got mortgages and kids.
Next story, the time is up for Bristol pubs. This is an excellent story, I think, anyway, Ron, in today's Evening Post. Bristol's pubs closed at a rate of one every 3 weeks over the past year. The traditional local is in danger of disappearing from many areas of the city forever, says the Bristol Pubs Group, who claim 18 locals have closed in the city in the last year alone, and two more are struggling to keep their doors open. Combination of the recession, changing drinking habits, increases in taxes and the smoking ban have made it harder for the old-fashioned boozer to survive. The organisation is part of the Campaign for Real Ale, and it says the licensed trade in some areas has been almost completely decimated.
I think that's quite right. I mean, you know, for once the facts haven't got in the way of a good news story. If you look at our area in St George, we lost a Don John to a flat development. We lost the Three Horseshoes to a flat development. The one thing they haven't mentioned there is the role of the major brewers in relation to having licensees as tenants, and the fact that they upped the prices and limited the choices in pubs and made beer a lot dearer.
So you're saying that actually it's the brewers that have been demanding higher profit margins, yes, from the licensees?
Yes, and in the end, people couldn't make a living, and so they ended up without tenancies, and so nobody would take it on, and so the pub shut, they got vandalised, and then as a basis of not keeping that as an uneconomic building, sold off and turned into something else, normally flats.
I wonder whether the breweries were looking at these places thinking, actually, now would be a really good time to sell our pub to make it into flats. It's worth a lot more as a housing development than it is as a pub.
Well, that is true, and I think that there's an element of truth in that. But, of course, the property market with the economy has taken a slight nosedive in that, and so I think they may have ended up with catching a cold.
Now, Martin, I know this is a subject very close to your heart, what are your thoughts about the reasons for this and whether it's going to carry on at this rate?
Well, I mean, let's face it, we're talking in an earlier part of the show about the collapse of the banks. I mean, in Ireland, the land of pubs, they are basically dying out because of the recession. And you've got a situation where the Irish won't go to the pub anymore. You know how serious it is. And there is also you know, changes in drinking habits, and also supermarkets selling stuff for knockdown. I mean, I have to say, I always buy the cheapest of what I want, because that's, you know, I haven't got a big budget. And, you know, there's got to be, we'll have to have a rethink about how we deal with alcohol.
So what's that,
stop.
Gin or lager?
Well, it just depends, doesn't it? But, you know, we need to have an overall policy for what we want to do with drugs like alcohol and other drugs as well. You know, we need to actually have a policy about it. And of course, you know, we also need to see the social benefits of local pubs particularly, because that's where you build social cohesion. And without places for people to meet and relax, the communities die. And then, you know, often in many communities, the only place where people actually meet and interact with people they don't really know is outside the school.
Well, Ron, we've heard also about the demise of many libraries in the Council of Brent, and possibly the knock-on effect will be right across the country after that decision this week. It seems there's an assault on our public space, the space that we share, our shared space.
Yeah, I think that's true, and I think it's true in relation to services from local councils and some of the problems, etc. So I wouldn't disagree with that.
Well, coming up now, Sky News at 6, thanks to this week's guest, Labour councillor for St George West, Ron Stone. After the news, Occupy Wall Street and driving.
bcfm.org.uk. BCFM News.